Next speaker is David Gibbs. David is a specialist in disability claims. He's been very successful in helping Morgellons patients and Lyme patients get disability and start receiving their benefits. So he's going to talk about disability claims as it relates to Morgellons.
Thank you, Cindy. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to meet with you all today. I've met several people since last year at the conference that started out. Several people are here that we're working with already on their disability cases. So I want to talk with you today. We don't have time to give you the complete Social Security Disability 101 primer. It would take a whole lot longer time. But I do want to address what I have found are three pretty key points that I hope you'll take these away today, and it will really help out a lot. First of all, is there anybody here who works for Social Security Administration or for the Disability Determination Service? Would you raise your hand? Well, I always wonder, because it's not that we're in an adversarial relationship, but often it does help us when we're discussing this issue to hear from the people from Disability Determination Service, because they're the ones who review the claim. It's not the Social Security Administration staff. It's DDS, Disability Determination Service, which is a state agency in everybody's state. And I always wonder, you know, from them, you know, what's going on with them. And often the DDS representatives, if they're in our group, usually are able to add to what we're talking about. So I want to share three things with you today. And I bring these points up because of the calls that I've gotten from all around the country and the comments from all the people I've worked with, that this is a real common misconception or a myth that I think is out there. First of all, do you have to have a diagnosis of Morgellons disease or something else to file for Social Security disability? Has anyone ever been told by somebody at Social Security or anybody else, hey, you can't apply yet, you don't have a diagnosis? A couple of folks have. I've heard it a lot. I've heard people say, oh, I called Social Security, and they says, well, you don't have a diagnosis of anything. You don't have a real disease because CDC issues about it. So therefore, they leave with an impression, well, I really can't apply because I don't have a named condition that's official. Well, first of all, folks, that is not true. In Social Security regulations, what we're trying to do is show the applicant has a condition that is listed in the big list that they have of medical conditions. They divide medical categories up, or conditions, into 14 big categories. And then there's dozens and dozens of individual medical diagnoses or medical conditions under those 14 categories. We call those a listing. And in the parlance of what we're doing, we have to prove that you meet a listing. And now let me modify that. Not that you just meet a listing, but that you meet or equal a listing. And that is critical to all of you. There's not a listing for Morgellons. There's not even a listing for Lyme disease. So in these kinds of cases, what we're really trying to prove is you may not have a name for what you've got, but you've got symptoms. And these symptoms are what are the impairments. And that's what it all comes down to with every case, no matter what your medical condition. It's the symptoms and how badly they impair you. And if we can show that you've got symptoms that are impairing enough, it doesn't matter what it's called. If you had chronic or congestive heart failure, we've got to show that a person has symptoms that keep them from working. Same with any disease. So really what we're able to do is prove that if you have these symptoms, they equal another listing, and even in a completely different kind of category. So that's part of the approach that we're able to take. So first item is, if you've been told you cannot apply because you don't have an official diagnosis of a named condition, that's not true. You can apply. So that's my first big point to think about today. Second big point to me that's important in these cases is that you do need to be seeing a doctor. Obviously, the frustration that you experience of going to doctors, it's amazing. We just heard the stories, you know, about a psychiatrist being told by a doctor that she's got delusions of parasitosis. The frustration of going to doctors who say, I don't know what you've got. Somebody told me at break they went to a doctor who said, oh, these are filaments from your sweater. Get out of my office. How frustrating. I'll give you my little story of frustration in dealing with my own doctor, my primary care doctor. You know, with Social Security people, the Social Security people will send you out for an exam. This is purely an exam. They're not looking at you for treatment. And we call these doctors, or their reports called a consultative evaluation. Now, realizing these people are paid by Social Security, so who do you think their loyalty is to? Many of them, in my opinion, seem to think we're here to say there's not much wrong with this person. And typically they do. One of my clients, who is a Lyme disease and Morgellons sufferer, was sent for a consultative exam and happened to be sent to my private doctor. So I got that report back, and I read it. And my private doctor, who I've been seeing 15 or 16 years, and I thought was a pretty decent, open-minded person, basically, in his report, stated that they produced some gauze, they wiped these sores, and produced these blue filaments. And you know what he diagnosed it? He didn't say delusions of parasitosis. He used a word called formication. Dr. Stricker, what does formication mean? It's the delusion. Yeah. It's delusional. You're delusional. So this guy, I guess he thought he was being cute or something, decides to name it formication and or doesn't think anybody's going to look it up, I guess. So I went to him for my annual checkup last year. And I was going to say, well, Doc, I need to ask you a question about this. And he called his assistant in to give me a flu shot. And I said, well, I have some questions I want to ask you, doctor. And the assistant said, well, if you want to ask questions, you have to make a separate appointment. Now, I had made an appointment for my annual physical. I thought that's when you ask your doctor questions. And I said, she said, you have to make an appointment. I said, I thought I did. My doctor stood up and said, I don't have time, and walked out. I'm proud to say I haven't seen him since, and he's no longer my doctor, and I have a new one. But again, the frustration is there in this. Now, if you think you're frustrated in dealing with your doctors, if you want to multiply your frustration level by about 10 or 20 times, let's file for Social Security disability. Social Security Administration has got to be as frustrating as any of the monster bureaucracies. I kind of look at, we've got three big monsters that we all end up dealing with in some way. Social Security Administration, the IRS, and a lot of people deal with the VA. And I deal with a lot of patients or clients who deal with the VA. So those are three monstrous bureaucracies who all, you know, they have their own world and their own rules they live by. I was talking about, should you be seeing a doctor, though? Yes, you should, even though that doctor may say, I don't really know what you have. And hopefully that doctor doesn't say, get out of my office. I don't want anything to do with you. Hopefully that doctor would say, I don't know what you have, but I really, these symptoms are real. And I want to help do something to try to treat the symptoms. See, it doesn't matter, as I said earlier, on the listings. We've won a case, for instance, somebody's doctor diagnosed these lesions, not as Morgellons, but as dermatitis with non-healing lesions. Okay? It doesn't matter what you call it. We won that case because of that. because we were able, and there's a listing for non-healing lesions, by the way, dermatitis. So it doesn't matter what's called. Won a case a couple of months ago because, and this kind of is interesting when you deal with the DOP issues. Basically, the doctors in this case said, we can't really figure out what is causing all this, but the symptoms are real, or at least this person believes these symptoms are real and is experiencing them. There's a condition called a somatoform disorder. Some people think that means it's all in my head. It doesn't really. Really what I feel like it means is you've got some conditions, and also your emotional condition adds to the problems, and those symptoms are real symptoms. And we've won cases using that. And it doesn't matter. People say, oh, don't tell me it's all in my head. I know it's not. I know it's not. But if we can win your case, and that's what we use, it doesn't matter. And in the whole Social Security thing, it doesn't matter what your condition is. If it qualifies within that big realm of listings, that's all that matters, is you're on and you're getting your benefits. Dealing with your doctor, though, is so critical because of this. You may not realize this, but the decision of whether a person is disabled or not is not a medical decision. Okay? The definition in Social Security parlance is of being disabled is this. A person is disabled if they have a medical condition that prevents them from performing substantial gainful activity. Okay? Substantial gainful activity is a dollar amount. It means that you have a medical problem that's caused you to cut back on your work or not be able to work at all, and it's caused your income to fall below this dollar amount that they have set, that's sort of a cutoff line. If you're above their dollar amount of SGA, you may be sick, you may be hurting, you may be in brain fog, you may have sores all over your body, but you're not disabled. However, if you earn your earnings as much as you can only work a little bit or not at all, and your earnings fall just a little bit below SGA, then yes, you might be disabled. This year, SGA is $980 a month. That means that if you make $981 a month, you're not disabled. If you make $970 a month and can't work anymore and earn more, then yes, you're probably disabled. So that's a fine line, though, to keep in mind, because it gets us to our other point of should I file and when should I file. But I'm going to get to that in a second, because I want to say just a little bit more about working with your doctor and why you need to have a doctor. The questions, again, with Social Security is not, do you have a medical diagnosis of something? And it doesn't matter, okay? The question really is, how severely does that condition limit you from working? So really, this whole thing comes down to a severity question. When you file an application and you are assessed by Social Security, by DDS really, they have a physician who, after they gather the medical records from your treating sources, they have a physician fill out a questionnaire. And that questionnaire basically is called an RFC. RFC means residual functional capacity. They're not measuring how much functioning you've lost. They're measuring how much you have left. Residual functional capacity. And I can guarantee you about 999 times out of 1,000, the RFC that they complete at DDS is going to say you can leap tall buildings with at least a single bound, and there's not really much wrong with you. I very, very have seldom have seen any of the RFCs that they complete that says anything other than that. Now, this is filled out by a doctor who's never seen you, has never treated you, has only looked at medical records from the sources that submitted their medical records. Now, how much weight does that doctor's opinion carry? Well, it's on the record, so it does carry weight. How do we overcome that kind of medical opinion that is either biased or prejudiced or just ignorant by a doctor who's never seen you? Well, obviously, we need to have a similar kind of opinion, or at least a questionnaire-type approach on how much your condition limits you, completed by a doctor who knows you, who's treated you, who's examined you in person, not just looked at medical records. They classify that as the treating physician. And I can tell you that the treating physician's opinion will always trump that DDS doctor's RFC who's never seen you. Your treating physician will be given what is called controlling weight in the judge's decision. So it's very, very important that we are able to get some kind of opinion about the severity of the limitations you experience from a treating physician, not a doctor you've just seen one time. You know, you saw Social Security's doctor just one time. They just did an evaluation. And that's what we're going to counter. We counter it by having a treating physician, somebody that's seen you, who knows you, who's examined you, and is trying to help you, and who's willing to complete a questionnaire. And I understand, too, doctors really are there to be treating their patients, and they don't usually like to fill out questionnaires. It seems to be unnecessary paperwork. And can be time-consuming. And sometimes doctors say, I'm not trained to answer these questions. Okay? But it is so critical that the doctor who is your treating doctor give us some kind of opinion. And I've asked doctors, try to complete part of my questionnaire. I've developed a questionnaire that really acts as a translation device. Most doctors don't speak in Social Security ease. They don't know the kinds of words that Social Security is looking for. One of the things that we run into a lot is many doctors are so willing to try to help their patients sincerely, and they will say, I'll do anything I can to help you. How about if I write a letter? And in the past, that was probably acceptable in some situations. Typically, a doctor will write a letter then that says something like, I've been treating my patient Bob for 4 or 5 years, and Bob has a condition called dermatitis with non-healing lesions. He experiences depression. He experiences anxiety. He has severe itching and non-healing lesions, and in my opinion as his doctor, Bob is disabled and is permanently disabled and cannot work. That used to sound good, but here's what really happens with that kind of letter. You know, I said that the term disability or disabled is not a medical decision. It's a legal decision. So what happens then at a hearing? You know, who makes medical decisions? Doctors. Who makes legal decisions? Judges. And so at a hearing in front of a judge, every time a judge will say, the decision on disability is reserved for the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, therefore this doctor's opinion does not count and we're throwing it out. You see, And it's a waste of the doctor's time and everybody else's time, because it will not help us when we have a letter written like that. For the doctor to say, I've determined my patient is disabled, is what is the backbreaker. What it helps to do, though, where a doctor can help, is give his opinion or her opinion on the symptoms and how these symptoms cause limitations. It causes my patient to not be able to sit for very long, a specific time. It causes them to be reduced on how long they can stand or walk. Big one is it impairs their attention, their concentration, their memory, those cognitive dysfunction areas. That's critical. But having your treating physician give those opinions about the limitations your symptoms cause is the key. Now, that's why I say it is important you have a relationship then with a doctor. And that doctor may again say, I don't know exactly what it is, but I know these are the symptoms, and I know this is how they impair this person's life. That is key. Other part I was going to talk about is, when do you file? Should I file now or should I wait? Some people say, hey, I'm still working. Should I file? Well, as I told you, if you are working and earning above SGA, substantial gainful activity, no, you should not apply, because you'll get kicked back because you're, by rule, not disabled. But at the point you're experiencing the symptoms that are causing you the fatigue, all of the symptoms that are impairing your ability to work, and it causes you to have to cut back on your work or even stop working, at that point, do not wait. File immediately. Okay? I've had a lot of people call me in the last year or so that have said, well, I was told I couldn't file, and I've waited, and now it's gotten so bad. I thought I was going to get well. I thought surely I would get well. We hear it a lot. And so I haven't filed. And I said, well, how long has it been since this has been going on? Well, it started back in 2000, and it really got bad in about 2003, and I actually stopped working in 2003. Big problem. Let me explain this about Social Security disability. How many of you are familiar with long-term disability insurance? You know, it's a product that you can purchase usually when you're employed, that Aflac, the duck commercial, that's long-term disability. That would pay you if you become disabled, unable to do that job, and you're out of work for 6 months, and then it would kick in and start paying you whatever their contract was, usually 50 or 60% of your salary, for whatever the contract term says. That's long-term disability. If you stopped paying the premiums, what would happen? Your coverage would stop, wouldn't it? Well, Social Security disability acts like long-term disability insurance. In fact, the agency refers to it as being insured. But unlike long-term disability insurance, whose coverage stops as soon as you stop paying the premium, Social Security disability will continue for a time period after that. You know, you're paying your premiums when you're working and your employer's withholding those monthly deductions from your salary. Those go in for taxes and also to Social Security. That's your premium. When you stop working, though, your coverage does not stop. Social Security uses a formula to basically give you credit for all the work that you've done all these years that will extend your insurance coverage under Social Security disability. It will extend it usually about 5 years from when you last worked and paid into the system. So let's say a person did stop working in 2006. You are probably still insured today in 2009. But if you stopped working in 2002, it's been more than 5 years. And there's a real chance that you have what we call a date last insured. This means the date that your Social Security disability coverage stopped. It will probably be 5 years from the last day you worked. And so in a case of a person who, let's say, who stopped working in 03, they have a date last insured, let's say, June of 08. Well, we're in April of 09 now. Are you still covered? Can you still apply? You can, but we're faced now with proving medically that your disability caused you severe enough limitations to be called disabled prior to that date last insured. Okay? And it's dreadful when people call and we find out their date last insured is a couple of years past already. It creates a huge challenge to try to go and prove that they were disabled before that. Now, we can do it. We had a Lyme disease victim in Waco who I think we proved she was disabled in 2001. So, you know, again, it's what we can do and work with doctors to prove that, but it can be done. But it creates a huge problem. So my message is, as soon as your income drops below substantial gainful activity, $980 a month, file your claim then. Okay? You may get better. I hope you do. I encourage all my clients that, hey, you're better off if you can work at anything than to be disabled. Okay? It should be a last resort. But the way this system works, go ahead and get your application started. Part of that reason, and anybody who's ever applied here will tell you, I applied and I got denied. Okay? This is a multi-stage process. And at stage one, the statistics, I just read the statistics from 08, and I have to say, things are getting better. The current commissioner of Social Security is probably the best one they've had in 50 years. And he's really working on speeding things up, trying to get rid of this ridiculously long waiting period that people go through. But you should apply, because at stage one, statistically, 64% of the people who apply will be denied. Now, that doesn't mean they're not disabled. It means that in this bureaucracy, at stage one, it's very much geared to deny you. Okay? That's two out of three applicants are denied at stage one. Who's the one out of three? Who wins? One out of three. That's usually somebody that's going to have a terminal condition or has extensive medical documentation about their condition, and we're able to get their doctor to fill out a questionnaire, and we can win cases at stage one. But it is difficult, and statistically it works against us. So we have to appeal that. One problem that people run into is they go, oh, well, I was denied. They must know what they're talking about. I'll forget it. I think they want you to do that. Realize that the people who denied you, they're geared to deny you, and that most likely you would be denied, so don't be frustrated by that. Just say, okay, that's just the first part of this process. And we go on to the second step. We have to file an appeal. It's always timely also. There's deadlines and time limits, so we have to stick to those. But we can work through this process. At stage two, we're asking the same people who denied you to change their mind, and they don't really like to do that. Their statistics from 08 are 83% are denied at stage two. That's worse than stage one. Now, that's a little bit better, because up until last year, it was about 85%, so it's improved 2%. That's really not much. So proving your case at stage two is very, very difficult. Just as it was at stage one. So we then file an appeal, and we go to stage three, and this is where we actually go in front of a judge live and in person. This is our very best chance to win the case. It's the only time the decision maker actually sees the applicant face to face. The only time. The rest are just done by people reviewing medical reports without wanting to read between the lines. and figure out what's going on with a real person. And it's at that hearing that we then need to present the questionnaire that your treating doctor has completed that talks about the limitations your condition impose. And it's doing that that we're able to win the cases. And it doesn't matter, again, if it's called Morgellons or anything else, but we have to be able to, by the time we're at a hearing, it's our very best chance. And to do it, we've got to have the right ammunition. And I can tell you, the silver bullet. You know, you don't fire the silver bullet, you know, just randomly because you only have one. And that's our questionnaire that we've developed. And so we want to use it with the judge because that's the real decision maker who can understand it. People say, well, why don't we file that questionnaire previously at stage one or stage two? It would be wasting it because the people who are reviewing your case at that time don't understand it, and they really are just, they're looking at black and white and not, they don't want to look at the gray areas. They want to look for something that they can use to deny you. We're looking for little tidbits that can say you should be allowed. The guys at DDS, bless their heart, they're looking for tidbits that they can use against you. And as soon as they get a tidbit that they can use against you, they will issue their decision denying you. They don't have to wait to get all the rest of the medical stuff in from your other doctors. As soon as they get one thing that they can use against you, they do that. That's the nature of that position. So I've talked about three big things. I've talked about you don't have to have a diagnosis, but you need to have the symptoms documented. You do need to be seeing a doctor because we're going to really call on that doctor to give us an opinion on the severity of your limitations. And third part, should you wait to file or file immediately? And my point is as soon as your earnings drop below $980 a month, file immediately. It's a process that can take a long time. It varies from state to state and from hearing office to hearing office. Here, our hearings go through the downtown Dallas hearing office, and our waiting period on a case is typically 9 to 15 months. That's from the time we request the hearing, and we request the hearing after stage two has been denied. Okay, so it is a lengthy process. And why does it take so long? Why does it take 9 to 15 months? Well, in Dallas, at that particular hearing office, there's about 7,000 people in line ahead of us. So that's part of the problem. Like I said, the commissioner's working now and trying to improve that. And they really are addressing it. They're trying to add more judges. But it's not changing very fast. Other hearing offices, and here's kind of it's good news that the Dallas hearing office is probably the most efficient one in the nation. So if you're right here in Central Texas, that's good news for you. If you're not, other hearing offices vary. I've got a Lyme disease case in Greenville, South Carolina, coming up in June. It's been 3 years waiting on getting the hearing scheduled. 3 years. The statistics show that the Greenville, South Carolina office is the absolute worst hearing office in the whole system. Okay, so you're ranging from 3 years at the worst hearing office to 9 to 15 months at probably the best hearing office. So it is a lengthy process. The system is overloaded. There's more applicants than ever, and that's only going to continue. So those are some issues. I want to answer questions. If you have any, I've put some brochures and some of my pens out front. If you need to ever call me and just ask questions, I'm always willing to talk with you and answer them. We work with clients all over the country. It's fun. Today I met one of my clients that I'd not met face-to-face who's here today, and that's really neat. But we've worked with a lot of clients. Dr. Stricker and Dr. Savely have been angels in this process of being willing to complete a questionnaire. And I promise you, that silver bullet makes such a difference. It does come down to it that if a judge is looking at all the medical information, it still takes somebody to decide, how does all this stuff limit this person? And remember, DDS already has twice had a doctor complete a questionnaire that I promise you they are trained to understate the limitations. It's amazing, but it's very clear that that's what they do. And interestingly, on their questionnaire, there is a question that says, is there a treating physician's statement in the file? What do you think they say? They always say, no, there's not, even if there were one. Why? Because if they say no, if they say yes, there is one, they then have to write a lengthy justification on why their opinion differs so greatly from the treating physician. And they don't want to do that much work. So it's easy to check the no box and go on and go to the next client. They're under a lot of stress. Disability examiner at DDS typically has 130 cases on their desk every month. And they don't care the outcome. They just have to get them off their desk. Have to process them. Usually when Social Security reports statistics about the success of the agency, it's not about how many people they're able to serve. It's about how many errors they made in processing. You know, how fast did a particular form travel through the system? So realize it's a process. They're in the process, totally. Well, those are the three points I wanted to get across today. I hope it's helpful to you.